It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up later, we'll talk about drowning prevention and keeping kids safe on the open water this summer. First, the Milwaukee Police Department released body cam footage yesterday of the January arrest of Milwaukee Bucks rookie Sterling Brown. In the video, several officers surround the 23-year-old and tase him before arresting him. The incident began when an officer confronted Brown over a parking violation. Formal charges against Brown were never filed. At the time, there were claims that Brown was combative and potentially threatening to officers. Many community leaders say the body cam footage doesn't match up with that story, though. Both the Milwaukee mayor and police chief expressed anger over the incident and apologized. Our next guest is here to talk about what happened, the reaction from top Milwaukee officials, and what this could mean for the police department. Eugene Kane is a former columnist with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Eugene, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. I'm good to be here.
What was your reaction? The story's been going on for a while. This video just came out yesterday. What was your reaction to what we saw?
Well, I think the initial reports in January, was it? They did paint a picture of a young black man being tased by police, so everybody was very interested to see exactly what happened. And I think the release of the police cam video actually makes the police department look very bad, because the suggestion that he was combative or that he did something to bring that on to himself is simply false. So now I think I'm feeling bad for black parents, African-American parents with kids around his age. He's a millennial, I guess, 22 years old or so. And they always fear what would happen if their children are in some kind of incident or confrontation with police. And just for a lot of them, this really confirmed things for them, that it's not safe out there if you meet up with the wrong type of officers.
Milwaukee Police Chief Alfonso Morales held a news conference yesterday to address the video. Here's some of what he had to say.
During the encounter, Mr. Brown was decentralized, tased, and arrested. Our department conducted an investigation into the incident, which revealed members acted inappropriately, and those members were recently disciplined. Criminal charges against Mr. Brown were not pursued. I'm sorry this incident escalated to this level.
And we're hearing reports today, Eugene, that officers involved were suspended for days, up to a couple few weeks. What do you think of what we're hearing from the police department now?
My initial reaction to the police chief was the sense that I've lived in Milwaukee a while. I don't think I've ever, and I've reported and covered these such incidences of police abuse and brutality, and even leading to death in some cases. And I've never really heard a police chief say that the officers were wrong. And I'm not really satisfied with the light suspensions they got. But it's a starting point that we have a police chief right now who will just say it like it is like that. So I think that probably gave some people some comfort. The mayor made good statements. But again, I mean, once you see it, and I've watched it a couple different times now, the videotape, I mean, there's just no excuse. And it causes me to really have concerns about how Milwaukee Police Department officers are trained. I mean, you're supposed to de-escalate situations like that, and they did nothing but escalate it. And I think anybody who suggests that Sterling Brown was combative or brought this on to himself just needs to watch the video. And you can see with your own eyes that, what, there were like 7-8 officers by the end of it? And they were the ones who I think raised the escalation factor in this. So it's just very disturbing all around, despite the fact that city officials, who clearly understand that they might be facing a big lawsuit, are now trying to put a good face on it and do the right thing.
Milwaukee Police Union President Mike Crivello, in a statement yesterday, said, quote, "Use of force never looks good, but I remind all that may hear that the amount of force is always dictated by the individual who may be resisting the arrest." And in the complete statement, suggesting that, hey, cooperate with police as much as possible. If you have a complaint, do it after, suggesting that Sterling Brown could have been more cooperative. What do you think?
My thoughts on that, he's a 22-year-old black man who clearly is of a generation that he's probably seen, and his statement that he released, where he basically made reference to former cases where innocent black men were ended up in some cases killed by police, and he referenced Dontre Hamilton in Milwaukee, which a lot of people remember. I think it shows his state, I'm not assuming, but I think it shows that he had enough information in his mind to be cautious, and I think that explains why he wasn't really combative or confrontational. He basically, I think, was on his best behavior for someone that young. I will add, I think if he was like 10 years older as an African-American male, he might have been a bit more cooperative or respectful. But I think it's crazy in this society that you impose those kind of things on innocent citizens who confront or meet up with police officers who are clearly not following their correct procedure anyway. So I'm not going to blame him for being a young black guy who was basically kind of, I think, upset that he was even being approached by the police. I do think he does know he parked illegally, but it's a near empty parking lot and it's early in the morning. So my attitude is that unless the cops involved really had a suspicion that maybe he was robbing this store, there's no evidence of that. In fact, it's been proven that's not true. I think if you're a police officer, you should be able to read situations. He came strolling out of the store. He wasn't running with a bag of money or anything. So I think I just don't want to let these police officers off the hook. They're supposed to be trained law enforcement officials, and they acted like a bunch of amateurs, in my opinion.
Talking to Eugene Kane, a longtime columnist in Milwaukee, about the Sterling Brown incident. Police body cam footage came out yesterday. Let's give a listen to Mayor Tom Barrett of Milwaukee talking about this.
This type of behavior, whether it's toward a professional athlete or any other citizen, has no place in our city. In fact, the reality that he's a professional athlete really has nothing to do with this. No citizen should be treated this way.
Eugene, if this weren't a prominent professional athlete, given that there were happily no fatalities in this incident, would we even be talking about this if this weren't a famous person?
Well, as a journalist, I understand one of the main factors in how much coverage some story gets is whether the person is a prominent person or not. So I think that's a given to say that it probably wouldn't have been covered this way if it was just a lone, unknown black man who was in the exact same circumstances who had been confronted by these officers. But that doesn't, you know, that shouldn't mean anything. Any person who gets tased unnecessarily and he's innocent and did nothing to bring it upon himself, we should show the most this as much concern. But of course, I concede that's the way the news media works. We look for a prominent person involved in this case, and that makes it sort of part of the news peg. So I don't have any real problems with that, but I think that it is important to note that it shouldn't matter if he's a famous person or not.
Sterling Brown released a statement through the Milwaukee Bucks after the video came out. He wrote, quote, situations like mine and worse happen every day in the black community. Being a voice and a face for people who won't be heard and don't have the same platform as I have is a responsibility I take seriously. So he is talking about this, going to keep talking about this. What do you think about Sterling Brown's response since this came out?
Oh, I was very impressed with it. I'm not going to assume he wrote every word of it himself, but I'm sure he had a lot of influence with it. So I think he stated it pretty much perfectly, because he's saying that just because I'm a pro basketball player, it doesn't mean my case is any more important than all the other cases. And again, I want to say young black people of his age have probably lived the last 10 years of their life watching or reading about these incidents. So they're not coming into this situation ignorant. They do understand what's been happening out there. And for him to use his situation, thankfully he's alive to tell it, which I think was a big part of his message, he actually got off easy because he wasn't killed, basically, by police. So I feel, and anybody who has any feelings about Sterling Brown should read his statement and realize that he's not some dummy or thug that was out there trying to start something. He's an intelligent black man who got caught up in a situation, tried to handle it as calmly as possible, and multiple officers just decided to kind of impose their official power on him simply because they didn't think, I guess, he was giving them enough respect.
As we wrap up, Eugene, this is a famous person. This was on video. Is there a sense, you've been in the community a long time, that this kind of thing happens a lot, but it isn't caught on camera? We don't hear about it. It's just kind of a fact of life for a lot of people in the Milwaukee area?
Oh, certainly. I think I've stated before on social media and other places, one of the biggest developments in issue of police community relations has been the cell phone video. Because even if it doesn't make the mainstream news, there are numerous incidents of minorities and African Americans in particular who go through this kind of stuff all the time. And if you are not in touch with that segment, you might be inclined to think, oh, this is just one little incident that happened. No, it happens, I don't want to say all the time, but it happens frequently. And people should take notice of that and put it into context.
Eugene, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for the invitation, Rob.
That's Eugene Kane, longtime columnist, a former columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joins us today to talk about the release of police body cam footage of the January arrest of Milwaukee Bucks player Sterling Brown. With Memorial Day just around the corner, many families across the nation will kick off summer with a trip to the beach. Whether it's a pond, river, lake, or even the ocean, there's a lot of fun to be had playing in and around the water, but there's also an element of danger. According to a new report from the group Safe Kids Worldwide, an estimated 1,000 children fatally drown in a single year in the United States. Many more end up hospitalized. The majority of these drownings take place during the summer months, and most of them take place on the open water versus places like swimming pools or bathtubs. So what should kids and parents know before hitting the beach this summer? Morag Mackay joins us now. She's the director of research at Safe Kids Worldwide and lead author of the group's new study, Hidden Hazards, an exploration of open water drowning and risks for children. Morag, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So we talked about it a little bit there. Put it into context for us. How big of a problem is childhood drowning here in the United States?
Well, it's a pretty big issue, actually. It's one of the leading causes of unintentional injury deaths across the country, and although the risk varies by age, it does come up as one of the leading causes in every single age group. And, you know, 1,000 children a year dying is big, and we have at least another 7,000 going to emergency departments. So we sort of estimate that about 150 families a week are being impacted by either a tragic or a really frightening event.
I think when people think drowning, they think of maybe swimming pools first, and that can be a concern, but your report focuses on open water in particular. Why is that?
Well, you're right. A lot of people do a lot of thinking about pools in the summer when it comes to drowning prevention, but we wanted to have a look at the data, and in fact, when we did, we saw that, actually surprising to many people, there are more open water drownings than there are drownings that occur in pools. It's about 43% of fatalities occur in open water, and by open water, we include both natural water like lakes, rivers, and the ocean, as well as man-made water like reservoirs, irrigation canals, and that sort of thing, compared to pools, which was at about 38% of all injuries.
What is it that makes open water potentially more dangerous, even if we think, oh, our kid is a solid swimmer, they do fine in the pool?
I think the thing is that the pool has, you know how big it is, you know the depth of it, and it's usually a smaller area that you're dealing with. But when it comes to open water, we've got things like limited visibility. The water can be murky. If you've ever gone swimming in a river or a lake, you know it's not always crystal clear. And that, number one, can hide hazards such as rocks and logs or sudden drop-offs. You know, as you're walking in the water, suddenly you get a big drop-off, and a child that's been walking and having fun can suddenly be under the water. And in addition, if a child does get in trouble and they do end up starting to drown, then they're less visible if that water is murky. But the other thing you have are things like distances. You often hear of stories where people start swimming and they get out so far and they don't realize how far they've gone, and they turn around and look for the shore and suddenly realize that it's much further than they're able to get back to. And then, of course, open water has things like currents or in the ocean tides, which can also create hazards for people. And finally, open water tends to be colder. So that can sap a child's energy. And again, they can be swimming, and you might think they've always done fine in the pool, but when they get out in open water, it can cause problems.
I want to spend some time on prevention. That's a big focus of your report. What should kids and parents know before that trip to the beach?
First of all, we really recommend that families use designated swimming and recreational areas whenever possible. At those areas, professionals have assessed it. There are usually signs posted around any hazards that exist, and often there'll also be lifeguards. And that's just an added layer of protection if you're out enjoying the water. Secondly, we always talk about the importance of supervision, especially with young children and inexperienced swimmers. They should be within arm's reach of an adult. But even for older kids, you should really have somebody. You know, mom might be doing one thing, dad might be doing another. Make a decision between the two of you who's watching the kids for that period of time. You can switch off, but ensure there's always someone that's making that their priority. We also talk about the importance of ensuring kids learn how to swim. Every child is different, but we sort of say after age 4, it's really important that kids start to learn how to swim. Before that, there are certainly classes that get them used to water, but research suggests that it's as of age 4 where they're really able to start to learn how to swim. And I think another really important one when we're talking about open water is learning water rescue skills and CPR. If you're at the pool, not so far to reach a child in open water, it might be a little bit further. And those basic rescue skills really help you to learn how to respond in an emergency without putting yourself at risk at the same time. Because I think we've all heard of those stories where a child gets into trouble and another child tries to help them and they get in trouble, and then an adult tries to help and they get in trouble. So learn those basic water rescue skills. Keep yourself safe as you're trying to rescue someone, and then learn CPR, because if you can start CPR before the emergency medical services arrive, you're increasing the likelihood that a child will survive.
Morag Mackay is with us from Safe Kids Worldwide. We're talking about safety on the water for kids this summer, especially out on the open water. Morag, I want to get back to the numbers you share in your group's new report. Some differences among different groups of kids. First of all, boys, way more likely to be victims of drowning. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's about 8 out of the 10 open water drowning victims are males. So this is probably something about how we socialize boys in terms of they tend to take more risks. And it may also be that as they get older, we're less likely to supervise them. And we certainly see a huge difference between the number of boys and girls who drown each summer.
And then you also find out that there are racial disparities in drowning. Can you talk about that a little?
Yes. In our research, we found that African-American children are twice as likely to fatally drown in open water compared to their white counterparts. And for American Indian children, that's an even higher risk at about 2.4 times the risk. There is research that suggests this is likely due to a difference in access to both swimming lessons and opportunities to swim in pools. So that they may be accessing open water more often for their water recreational activities, but certainly they also are less likely to be able to swim to begin with, which puts them at greater risk.
We talked about what individual families can do. Are there outreach efforts that you'd like to see at the national level to help bring those drowning numbers down?
Well, there has been a lot done to make pool safety, but of course, open water is a different proposition because we can't really address standards for it. But what we do really talk about is the importance of personal flotation devices for folks that are going out and doing water recreational activities. There is a requirement for all waters where the Coast Guard is responsible that anybody 13 and under is wearing a life jacket or personal flotation device. For other settings where it's not the Coast Guard, it varies state to state, and that can vary between age 6 to 16. So we would really like to see that age increase. And in fact, we recommend that anybody that's out on the water participating in a water recreational activity wears a life jacket or personal flotation device that's appropriate for their weight and the activity that they're participating in.
And Marijke, I wanted to get to one more suggestion, one more point you raise in the report. When you're watching your kids, when you're watching to make sure they're not drowning, a lot of us don't know what drowning looks like. We have it exactly wrong.
Yes, I think part of that is that Hollywood and television has led us to believe that you're going to see lots of waving and yelling and splashing when someone starts to drown. But in fact, for children in particular, when they begin to struggle in the water, something called the instinctive drowning response kicks in. And what this means is that older children are not going to be able to wave their arms because they are extending them out to the side, pressing down on the water just to try and keep themselves lifted out of up out of the water so that their mouth is above the water and they're able to breathe. But younger children don't even have the strength to do this specific response. So they often remain just in the water with little or no movement in their arms and legs, and they certainly can't yell because they're just trying to breathe. So it's often quiet. It happens extremely quickly. And once that whole process begins, it can take less than 20 seconds before a child starts to sink below the surface. So it's fast and it's silent, and that's scary. And that's one thing we really want parents to understand, is they aren't likely to see a lot of yelling, splashing, or waving. It's going to be quiet, and it's going to happen quickly.
Marijke, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Marijke Mackay, Director of Research at Safe Kids Worldwide, lead author of the group's new study, Hidden Hazards, an Exploration of Open Water Drowning and Risks for Children. First, if you have siblings, having a healthy relationship with them can be a great source of friendship, a support system in tough times. It can even help with mental health in old age. But not everyone feels warmly toward their siblings, and even siblings who mostly get along can run into some rough patches through the years. Our next guest says there's a lot you can do to maintain your sibling relationship, no matter if you want to be best friends or just there to help each other when needed. Jeff Greif is a professor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work. He's the author of many journal articles and 14 books, including Adult Sibling Relationships, published in 2016. Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you and your colleague had this book come out a couple years ago, and I understand you found that there wasn't as much research on how siblings get along as a lot of other family relationships. Why do you think that is?
It seems to be that a lot of therapists have been trained in looking vertically at relationships, first of all, parent-child relationships, and secondly, at couples relationships. So this, what I call horizontal relationship, a sibling relationship, tends to have been ignored until the last 20 or so years. But as people live longer lives, they're going to need their brothers and sisters longer than ever before. And this is the longest relationship that we have. We are with our siblings longer, usually, than with our closest friends, and certainly longer than with our parents and our children and our partners.
And I think, Jeff, the ideal is that, well, your siblings, of course, you're going to get along. It's a natural relationship, no problem. But you write that it can take work. It can take some effort. Do we need to kind of recalibrate the way we think of that?
Yeah, we sort of have this Rockwell-esque view that everybody's going to get along every time they get together at Thanksgiving or at some other holiday. And in fact, many siblings that we interviewed, and we had survey data from over 350 siblings talking about 700 plus sibling relationships. While most people said they were close with their siblings, when you dug a little bit deeper into that, alongside the affection that many of us feel for our siblings, there's also a tinge of ambivalence and even some ambiguity, and we can get into that, you know, further if you wish.
Yeah, what are some of the things that lead to that ambivalence?
Well, of course, and I have an older brother and sister, I want my brother and sister to do well, but not as well as me. And I cheer for them, but I was aware, our parents are now deceased, but I was aware growing up that there was always competition between us, and there's nothing wrong with good, healthy competition. But I would often be upset by things they might say and do. We have millions and millions of interactions with our siblings over the course of a normal lifespan, and the odds of all of them being loving and supportive are pretty slim. So there are often things that are said. Maybe every listener can remember something negative that they heard from a sibling at some point and hold on to that, and that maybe gets privileged more at some point than even some of the nicer things that have happened. So ambivalence would be a normal type of reaction, and we are trying to, Mike Woolley and I, my co-author, are trying to normalize this, that don't expect yourself to always have affection for your sibling, and be comfortable with the fact that having mixed feelings is a pretty normal thing, even with those that we are close with and whom we love.
Even in a great sibling relationship, I mean, you go from usually living in the same house to living in different places, maybe different cities, you have your own lives. Is there a natural tendency to just sort of drift apart, even when you like each other?
Well, the normal course of events, at least in America, is that we grow up and we're supposed to separate from our parents in early adulthood and from our family and establish our own relationships, our own identity. And we're usually able to do that, establish our own lives, until we have to come back together with our siblings to take care of ill and dying parents. So in theory, I could have ignored my siblings for a number of years, but all of a sudden, as our parents aged and became sick, we needed to come together to figure out what to do about them. And that's where some of the stuff that maybe we had all swept under the carpet had to be sort of unswept again and studied to make sure that that wasn't affecting the care that we could give our parents. Parents should know that if their adult children get along well, they're going to be taking better care of those adult parents. So there's a lot hanging on us trying to figure out how to do these sibling relationships as well as we can.
Talking to Jeff Greif from the University of Maryland School of Social Work, talking about sibling relationships, how to maintain them, how to build healthy ones through the years, even after we don't live in the same house anymore. Jeff, you mentioned, you referenced earlier the perception, maybe the reality, that some kid in the family was the parent's favorite. Mom liked you best, that kind of thing. How do siblings on either side of that navigate that in later years?
Well, one of the things we talk about in the book, and this is really difficult sometimes for both the children and the parents, but one of the things we talk about is that it's no fun being the least favorite, and it's also no fun being the favorite in many times. If that favoritism comes with it, if what comes with the favoritism is a certain anger or resentment from your other siblings, or if you're favored and you feel it comes with some unspoken obligation to a parent. So while, of course, parents have long relationships with their children, the more they can balance them out and try and show as equal a love for all their children as they can, I think the better off they will be. And sometimes that favoritism that is in childhood continues on into adulthood. Healthy families can sort of look at that and say, oh, yeah, we always knew that Susie was mom's favorite, and it was just funny. We used to joke about it. That's a healthy reaction to it. But in some families where there's more dysfunction, that sort of favoritism can take on a more sinister or a more dark nature and cause the children to become angry with each other.
And you mentioned the sibling relationship is, just by the sheer math, probably the longest relationship a person who has a sibling is going to have in their life. That can be great. It can be a really long time to nurse a grudge or a grievance, too. How can a sibling kind of triage, like, what can I let go? What do I need to bring up and talk about? Is there something that maybe I can't forgive? How do we start to sort that out?
Well, that's a very complicated and important question. Part of it is going to be what do you, the aggrieved sibling, want to achieve? A lot of people look at their siblings, consider their siblings, and realize that they are not going to be able to get that much closer to them than they are now. So the narrative they may have to say to themselves is, I'm going to make an attempt to get closer, but I'm not going to try that hard because I don't think it's going to work. I think part of the question is, do I want to think of myself, if I want to be closer to my sibling, or if I'm angry at a sibling, do I want to think of myself as somebody who is capable of reaching out to somebody else? Or do I want to think of myself as somebody who has tried and I'm not going to try anymore? It hurts too much. I'm just going to quit on this. So part of this is, what is the narrative that we want to have in our own lives? And hopefully sort of dysfunction in one's relationship with one's sibling doesn't bleed into dysfunction in one's relationships with one's own partner and children.
I don't want to focus only on the negative here, Jeff. What are the benefits of a positive relationship with your sibling through the years?
Yeah, it's pretty well established that people with friendships live longer, happier, healthier lives. In other words, one's social network is very important, and good, nurturing social networks can help somebody in a lot of ways. The corollary is, of course, having good relationships with one's siblings can also then lead to happier, healthier lives. There are often times when families are forced to get together, either by at a funeral, but also at a wedding or other family events, holidays. And if one can get along better with one's siblings, it's going to make that better, that time better. But I think even more importantly, it's a legacy of what you're handing off to the next generation. If you're not close with your siblings, you put at risk your children not being at close with each other, and those children being cut off from their first cousins and other family members.
We're talking to Jeff Greif, professor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work, author of the book Adult Sibling Relationships. We're talking about how to maintain or rebuild good relationships with our brothers and sisters. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like you have a good relationship with your siblings, if any? Do you feel like it takes some work to keep up that contact? Are you do you live in the same town or across the country from each other? What's helped to strengthen your relationship over the years? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. We're talking to Jeff Greif, professor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work, author of the book Adult Sibling Relationships. We're talking about sibling relationships and how we can create stronger bonds with our sisters and brothers as adults. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you and your siblings best friends? How has your relationship changed when you were kids? Were there obstacles to overcome over the years? Did you overcome those, or are things still tricky? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. To your calls now, Ricky is with us in Mosinee. Ricky, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to tell us about?
All right, well, you asked about circumstances that altered sibling relationships. Well, when I was 10 years old, my sister and I lost our father to a sporadic blood clot. God bless his soul. But his passing was very abrupt, and it sort of drove a nail in between us because I lost my father figure while she kept our mother in her life. And so for her to have that role model always above her, I always felt sort of secluded, you know. And so I never understood how to really patch my way to her because I didn't have a father to look up to, was while she had a mother to role model herself as to. So as far as like having a sibling relationship, we have a very good quality relationship, I believe. But I mean, I live in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, and she lives in Eau Claire, so it's hard to see each other unless, like you said, you come together for a wedding or a funeral and something like that. I don't know, it's difficult.
Ricky, thanks a lot for that call. Jeff, let's, and I'm very sorry for that loss at an early age.
Yeah.
Ricky, thanks for sharing that story with us. Jeff, can you talk about that when siblings go through a traumatic event like that at a young age together? It might bring them together. It might create difficulties, as Ricky says.
Right. Yeah. No, I'm also sorry, Ricky, for the loss. And yes, it can certainly split apart families. It can pull families together. The good thing about a long life is that, and maybe I'm being overly optimistic here, there are always chances to repair relationships, if not perhaps with a mother and sister, then with maybe finding other people in one's life to whom one can be close. So my, you know, hope would be that, Ricky, you would continue to look for connections to other people that can be meaningful, and figure out somewhere to place or mourn the loss of the relationship that you may or may not be able to get from your mother, but I think specifically with your sister. So I would encourage you to continue on that path, and the fact that you called is an indication that you're willing to reach out to try and get somebody else in your life and get some help for yourself.
Ricky, thanks a lot. Hope that helps. We'll go next to John on the line in Madison. John, hi.
Hi. There are 4 kids in my family. We're all adults now. One of the kids was our dad's favorite, which was always fun, until our dad died and left most of his inheritance to that one favorite. And then it wasn't funny anymore. And, you know, we felt awful crass, you know, having this division come up just over money, but because we were always close beforehand. But it happened, and I don't know. Parents shouldn't do that when they write their wills.
John, thanks a lot for that call. Sorry
right.
about that difficulty in your family. This is probably not the only family this has happened in, Jeff.
Right. This is something that when you speak to people that have struggles with their siblings, and when we interviewed social workers and psychologists that were treating these situations where siblings were struggling. Of course, a lot of it was around favoritism. A lot of it was around estate planning and how sometimes siblings knew in advance that they were cut out or reduced in a will, and sometimes they did not find out until after the will was read at their parents' death. So estate issues come up a lot when siblings don't get along. There are also some promises maybe that a dying parent might make to a son, saying, I've always wanted you to have this piece of art. And then in comes the daughter 2 days later, and the parent says the same thing to that, to the daughter, and the parent may not be of sound mind and body. In John's case, it seems to have been a continuation of other issues that were there. And of course, one option, which I don't know if that's ever going to happen, is for the sibling that got the most money to decide to split it up and not continue a legacy of favoritism through the next generations.
John, thanks for that call. We're talking about sibling relationships with Jeff Greif from the University of Maryland School of Social Work. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We have Joe with us now in Western Wisconsin. Joe, hi.
Afternoon. Hey, thanks for taking the call up. So my question really revolves rather currently around some of the politics of the world. And me personally, I wouldn't share my table with someone who is like super unkind or has horribly diverse, different political affiliations or perspectives than I do, or might be spewing hate or unkindness on Facebook. But yet the world says blood is thicker than water. We need to be family and we need to stick together. I find it continually challenging today, especially with social media and people's thoughts and opinions being so public, to navigate that line between, do I share the table with a sibling that I don't particularly care for very much, maybe they don't care for me as well.
Joe, I want to jump in. Jeff, thanks a lot for that call, Jeff, navigating political social differences among siblings.
Yeah. This came up especially around October and November of 2016, as you can imagine, and that's a very common reaction both about siblings and about friendships in general. And of course, you can more easily drop your friends than you can drop your siblings out of your life. One of the differences in the relationships. One of the things to think about is if it's with siblings, is to sort of make an agreement up front. When we get together for Thanksgiving, let's agree to not talk about this and try and separate that out. Now, whether or not anybody can do that, depending upon what is being said, if there are issues being raised of sexism or racism or, you know, fill in the rest, it may be, from an ethical or moral point of view, impossible. So one's going to have to pick and choose one's battle. But if a sibling can decide that I really want to try and preserve this for the good of my own parents and the good of my family, and I'm going to have to learn to ignore or not talk about this topic, but that's such a personal decision that it's hard to sit here in Baltimore and, you know, say anything more about that.
Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Good luck navigating that with your family. We go next to Jane in La Crosse. Jane, hi.
Hi. Yeah, this is so deep because, you know, there's so much that could be said. I come from a family of seven children. I was the middle oldest girl, and so ended up being kind of the matriarch of my family because there was alcoholism in my family. My youngest sister and I, who I helped raise, we have had a lot of contention in our relationship, and I'm 64, and she is now 59. So the cool thing is we went on our first, long road trip to pick up her son just last October, and for us to be in a car for even an hour used to be impossible, and we decided to do this trip because we could feel that we'd been on a good track for a while. And honest to God, we went on this whole trip that lasted us like 6 days. And even with her son in the car, I don't know how we did it, but we have crossed that. I think we just decided life is too short. And that is where we are really great. And the rest of our family, we lost a couple brothers really early on. And when you come from a family of alcoholism, I think as children and siblings, you kind of raise yourself. Mm.
Jane, I have to jump in because we're very close to being out of time. Thank you so much. I'm glad that worked out with your sister. Jeff, just less than a minute left. A quick thought to embrace that life's too
note.
Short.
That's a great positive note. A lot of the siblings we talked to when a parent died or when something happened, they just said, look, you're all I have left, and I'm going to have to figure out what to do with it. I can't, you know, say anything more about that because it's such a personal decision. But at some point, you're going to have to figure out what's the narrative around your story and around the story for your children and grandchildren that you want to write about your family.
We'll leave it there. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful.
That's Jeff Greif, professor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work. He's the author of 14 books, including the book Adult Sibling Relationships. He joined us to talk about maintaining sibling relationships as an adult. Still time for you to share your story about you and your siblings. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know maybe if you had that moment like Jane did, where you got it back together, had that fun road trip, and worked things out for the future. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know there. Wisconsin has a gerrymandering case before the U.S. Supreme Court. And a gerrymandering is that thing where politicians draw the voting maps to minimize the impact of voters on the other side. Gerrymandering is a well-known process in American politics, but it turns out most of us, me included, have been getting something very wrong about it. We're saying it wrong. As reported in the Wall Street Journal, the politician who gerrymandering was named after, way back in 1812, pronounced his name with a hard G, Eldridge Gerry. Gerry. So it should not be gerrymandering, it should be gerrymandering. Gary's great-great-great-grandson is still trying to correct the record, writing letters to dictionaries and to media outlets, trying to get him to pronounce his great-great-great-grandfather's name right. And UW-Madison professor Barry Burden was quoted in that Wall Street Journal piece saying that he goes with the hard G gerrymandering, which sounds to me, I'm convinced, is correct, often leaving students and colleagues confused. I went back to an interview with him. I tried to find him saying the word. I missed it. I couldn't find it there, him saying gerrymandering. So what do we do about this? I think I'm going to try saying gerrymandering on the air in the future and maybe fight against this tide of mispronunciation. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Let me know what you want me to do with gerrymandering versus gerrymandering. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.